Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, we look back 50 years when the final Apollo lunar mission was underway. But first, we have Space Show News. After its 25-day trip around the Moon, the Artemis 1 Orion capsule returned to Earth on Monday morning. Approaching Earth from high over Western Australia, Orion made a descending arc over the Indian Ocean, then Antarctica. Heading northwards across the southern Pacific Ocean, the capsule separated from the European-built Cepheus module, then slammed into the atmosphere. Descending on three parachutes, the Artemis 1 ended its mission with a splashdown several hundred kilometres off the coast of Baja California. Meanwhile, the Japanese Hakuto-R lunar landing mission is now on its way to the Moon. It was sent on its way by a Falcon 9 rocket launched on Sunday afternoon from Cape Canaveral. After a circuitous route, Hakuto-R is expected to land on the Moon in April. Aboard are two small rovers, one from Japan and the other from the United Arab Emirates. Also aboard the Falcon 9 was a NASA craft. It was released soon after the Hakuto-R to fly independently to orbit the Moon. Called Lunar Flashlight, this low-cost spacecraft will shine lasers into dark craters to search for water ice deposits. It will be mid-year next year before Lunar Flashlight is in an operational elliptical orbit that will see it swooping repeatedly over the lunar South Pole.
I'll be by to get you in my old moon buggy. We will find the crater where we're stuck in hooky. And up there by the light of the good old earth, we'll love it up like everything for all that we're worth.
50 years ago today, Gene Cernan and Harrison Smith were in the Taurus Littrow Valley on the Moon, and Ronald Evans was orbiting the Moon alone. As Joey Dixon has just reminded us, the two moonwalkers didn't have to walk everywhere. They had an electric moon buggy, the Lunar Roving Vehicle. In later years, all three Apollo 17 astronauts visited Melbourne. The Space Show caught up with two of them. Peter Arwood asked Gene Cernan this question.
Just want to ask you a quick question. What, in your opinion, is the most important and meaningful thing to come out of human spaceflight as opposed to unmanned spaceflight, and more specifically from the Apollo program, in your opinion?
Well, you know, we can talk about all the technological spin-offs. They're certainly important, but the technology of Apollo, and we couldn't have done it, you know, at that point in time without people literally creating the technology that we needed. When the president said, we're going to go to the moon back in 1961, I don't think many people, including yours truly, believed it could be done. We didn't know beans about getting to the moon. We had a lot of learning to do, and we certainly made our measure of mistakes along the way. And it cost us, without question, it cost us. But when you look back, the technology of Apollo is, I think, is already obsolete, overshadowed by time. These young kids have got more technology, more memory in their iPhones than I had in both of my hands when I landed on the moon. And so, and the questions people get, people ask all the time, are really. How did it feel? What did it look like? Were you scared? Did you feel you wouldn't come home? What do you do when you don't, you know, when you're not out on the road? What's your family like? And on and on, but they were all questions. I like to compare if, you know, if you had Neil Armstrong and Christopher Columbus in the same room at the same time right now. I really believe you'd ask about the same questions. How did you feel? Did you think you wouldn't get back? Did you think you'd sail off the flat Earth? How did you feel when you first stepped on the moon and saw land? Those are the things people want to know. And when you look back, what do I think the most important thing is? I guess we're getting right back to where we started. It's the inspiration of people, and you said it earlier, not just young people, but young and old, to do what they didn't believe was possible. We had the whole world believing we could do it after we got after it for a few years. People got on board, and I guess I was one of those guys once I got selected for the program. And you get involved, and you believe it. You don't believe you can't do it. You know, it's that kind of thing. And the next thing you know, you're standing on a moon and you've done it. Yeah. And it still seems unreal. It still seems magical. It still seems to some degree like it's a dream, you know, some kind of science fiction dream, and you find yourself in this unbelievable place and you pinch yourself, am I really here at this moment in space and time and history? And the fact of life is, it's real. You've done it. And if I can do it, there's no reason every young boy, every young girl, every young man, every young woman in the world can't do something like this. And as a matter of fact, we owe it to future generations to explore. Mm. We literally owe it to open the doors to the future. Because, you know, otherwise you wither and die. If you don't grow as humanity, where do you go? What happens?
Cernan was eager to distinguish between darkness and blackness.
When you were in space, was it extremely dark?
Dark?
Yeah.
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, yes and no. You know, there's a lot of paradoxes when you go to the moon. We were in daylight the whole time. You used the word dark. I use the word blackness. Darkness is when you're in a shadow, in our case, here on Earth or on the moon, of the sun. That's darkness, when you're in the shadow. And we were in sunlight. We lost at darkness from the Earth on Apollo 17, and that was because of where we were landing. But soon we came into sunlight. And once we left the Earth, we were in sunlight all the way to the moon until we came into the shadow on the moon. We got the moon between the sun and us, and we were then in darkness. But when you look back at the Earth and you look through that sunshine, and this is the paradox, and you look through that sunshine, and there's nothing for the sun to shine on except maybe the Earth itself, the multicolor blues of the oceans and whites of the snow and the cloud. And everywhere else along, you could look just a skosh alongside the Earth, and you are peering into the deepest blackness that you can conceive in your mind. I didn't say darkness. You're looking through sunlight, and you're peering at a three-dimensional blackness. I call it the endlessness of space and the endlessness of time. There's nothing there. There's nothing for the sun to shine on. So it is totally black.
During one of his visits to Melbourne, geologist, astronaut, and Senator Harrison Smith spoke to a small group at the Redback Brewery Hotel. Well, of course, the space show was there.
Let's talk about what happened then in 1972. It was the final mission. Did you know it was going to be the final mission?
We actually were aware that the missions beyond Apollo 17 had been canceled beginning about early 1970. Various decisions were made both by the administration and by NASA, the Nixon administration and by NASA, to begin to pull back from the Apollo commitment. The original funding for Apollo contained the provisions for building, which were done, building about five more rockets and spacecraft than we actually used to go to the moon. Some of those were used for the Skylab program in the mid-1970s. Some of you may be aware of the first space station program, really, of the Earth. And unfortunately, three of the rockets are lying on their sides museum pieces now.
I think I've seen them. They're not rusting, so that's good. They're still being
repaired. Well, it's hard to say what's happening to them. One in Florida is particularly in good shape because it's now been put under cover, although it did sit outside for about 25 years. The decisions probably were unfortunate, I think, in the wrong reach of history. Not continuing to utilize the Apollo capability of going into deep space, particularly the large rockets, would be termed a mistake. But you also have to look at it in the eyes of the politicians and others at the time, particularly the news media. The news media had sort of gotten bored with going to the moon, and unfortunately, sometimes that happens. Things that are continuously positive are difficult to cover, I guess, and we just have to learn to deal with that. More importantly, the United States and indeed many other countries were deeply involved in Vietnam. There were other issues coming up politically relative to retirement and health security, and the Nixon administration just decided not to keep asking for the resources to use the hardware that had already been bought. It costs just about as much to use it as it did to build it, so they saved some money there, I guess. But you still have to wonder about that decision to not at least run out the use of the vehicles that were already available. However, in the really long reach of history, 30 years, probably more like 40 years now, before we return to deep space, will probably not turn out to be as nearly as significant as the Apollo program itself was to history. Human beings, I think, humankind is pretty well committed now to heading into deep space at some time in the not-too-distant future, going back and probably going back to stay. Certainly the resources are available on the moon to support human settlements. They clearly are available on Mars. And I just do not think that if you look at human beings really as a biological species, that we will wait too much longer before we're actually going forward into space and planning to stay there.
I'm going to be turning it over to you for some questions shortly, but I'll just pick up on this one, if I may, and that's the question of resources. I mean, I've seen a couple of statements from you which say that there are all the resources that are needed on Mars and on the Moon to sustain human habitation. Now, let's just take the Moon. It certainly doesn't look like it from here.
Well, they're not. I think you said ore or oil?
Ore. Oh.
Yes. Well, the primary resource that I think can take us back to the moon commercially is an energy resource. It's a light isotope of helium called helium-3 that is a nearly ideal fuel theoretically for fusion power. When you fuse,
so fusion power, for those who don't know, which is me, nuclear fusion
power is the combining of atoms versus fission power, which we're familiar with here on Earth now. France, I think, is almost 80% now producing its electrical power with nuclear fission reactors. Fission power is the splitting of atoms to gain energy. Fusion is somewhat more difficult. It's combining of atoms, but clearly, theoretically, we know a lot about it, and experimentally, there's been a fair amount of progress. The joint European Torus reactor, a fusion reactor in Great Britain, has set some significant milestones in fusion using two isotopes of hydrogen, deuterium and tritium. That fusion process is well known. It's relatively easy compared to using helium-3. And we have learned a great deal scientifically about what we call plasmas because of the research going on in that particular style of fusion. However, it has become very apparent to many, at least those outside of governments, that the commercialization of a deuterium-tritium fusion power cycle is going to be very difficult, probably impossible. It's just very, very expensive. They require the use of extraordinarily large magnets. You have to build very, very large machines to get to break even and to actually produce more power than you put in. And that is really what led my colleagues at the University of Wisconsin to start to explore alternatives, and one of those alternatives turned out to be discovery by them that the geologists and geochemists who had been studying the moon had found this isotope helium-3 in the lunar soils at significant concentrations. Just to give you some perspective on why one might be interested, a metric ton of helium-3 at today's prices, crude oil prices, has the energy equivalent of about $5 billion worth of crude oil. So a metric ton of helium-3 and $5 billion worth of crude oil have about the same amount of energy in them.
That's billion with a B.
That's with a B. That's right. And that's U.S. dollars, by the way. Sorry.
The real ones.
Yeah. And, well, not necessarily real dollars, but that's what my mind works in right now.
Just one thing before I turn it over to you. Have you noticed this? He's the first American I've seen walk into a pub and ask for a Guinness. Where'd that come from?
Well, it came out of a barrel, I think. No, I have always, for a long time, thought very highly of Guinness and stouts in general, and that's what I like to have.
All credit to you. All right, who's first? Who wants to go? Yell it out nice and loud. Don't have to put your hand up. Anyone like to talk to Harrison? Could be anything. What did the moon look like when you stepped out of the pod? How can I find out more about fusion power, whatever it is? Yeah. I should point out for those who don't know that Harrison is described as being the first scientist to go on the moon. The rest of them were Buzz Lightyears, apparently, but you were the first scientist.
Well, I was the first professional scientist with a significant amount of experience in geology before I was selected as an astronaut. And a number of other scientists were selected at the same time, but I happened to be the only geologist, and so it was probably going to be fairly certain that if any scientist went to the moon in the Apollo program, it would be I. However, you have to realize that we accomplished a great deal of science by training the test pilots as sort of field geological assistants. Until I was able to go, that's really the way they operated, and we had a very extensive training program, particularly beginning with Apollo 13.
It's not the same as having a scientist there, though, is it?
No, it's not. It's the same as if somebody plucked me out of geology and said, go test that airplane. You know, I wouldn't know very much about it, and I wouldn't have an experience base to do it, and it would take a long time for me to develop that experience base. When you have certain jobs to do anywhere, and particularly in space, it's, I think, now clear that you take the people who are professionally qualified to do that job, give them the other skills they need in order to operate safely and reliably in space, but take advantage of their professional experience and training. And I think as a result of the initial scientist-astronaut group, the six of us, all the rest of whom, except for one, flew in the Skylab program, that now that's understood. The space shuttle program, now the space station activities do include the presence of payload specialists, mission specialists, which is just a euphemism for scientists and engineers and other physicians and others who can bring their experience to bear on those kinds of tasks. Whether or not having more scientists would have helped in gaining the public's interest, I don't know.
Apollo 17 astronaut and geologist Harrison Schmidt at the Redback Brewery Hotel in North Melbourne. More about Apollo 17 coming up.
Wishing you a very Merry Christmas.
This is Southern FM.
Walking on the moon. During his time as a politician, Harrison Schmitt had to weigh up the merits of the views of people who advocated going to Mars, bypassing a return to the moon, and those who argued we need to learn on the moon the skills and technologies needed to go to Mars.
Well, my elevator speech is that I think we have to go back by way of the moon, because that's the only way I know we're going to get the infrastructure developed, technological infrastructure, to continue to operate in deep space. The moon has the resources that may pay for that through investors or through governments. I suspect investors more likely. And once we have that infrastructure for the moon reestablished, then clearly planning and implementation of going to Mars, it becomes far less costly and I think much more feasible than it is today.
Down in Frankston, Schmitt gave this vivid description of the Saturn V rocket that propelled him and his two colleagues to the moon 50 years ago.
And we'll begin to take a trip to the moon. I think we have to turn the machine on there. And we're going to begin that trip with a sort of summary slide that illustrates the beginning of an Apollo mission to the moon, in this particular case, the Apollo 17 mission. The Saturn V rocket and the spacecraft, which were up here in this section, was truly a remarkable achievement technologically and from a human point of view. The first thing I want to remind you of, those of you that are familiar with the movie Apollo 13, is that in that movie you might have gotten the impression that the people of Apollo, particularly those in mission control and the engineers and others who were working Apollo diligently, were in their late 30s and early 40s. In actual fact, they were in their 20s. They were just out of engineering school in various places in the United States, and indeed, actually, throughout the world. There were a significant number of Australians and others who came to the United States in response to the challenge that President John Kennedy gave us in 1961 to go to the moon and return safely to Earth. And that program was not only internationalized by that a small migration of engineers and skilled workers, but also by the sample analysis program and many other activities that were truly made into international efforts. The Saturn V rocket, however, is still the largest rocket ever to be used to take human beings into space. It weighed 6.8 million pounds, fully fueled, about 364 feet high. It had thrust in the five big engines here of 7.5 million pounds when they were ignited and at full thrust. This building in which it was assembled at the time and for many decades afterwards was the largest contained space constructed by man on Earth. It has since been eclipsed, I'm sorry to say, by a mall in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And not to be satisfied with that, they're enlarging it. But this vehicle assembly building is fully utilized today. That's where all the space shuttles are assembled prior to their flight.
Back at the Redback, Schmitt was answering more questions.
My feelings, once we were down on the surface of the moon and had a chance to get outside, were really feelings at two levels, emotionally, I think. One, I really was trying to record in my mind as much as I possibly could about the experience of this valley was deeper than any valley I had ever been in, certainly deeper than the Grand Canyon of the Colorado in the United States. The mountains were 2,100 meters on either side of us, quite narrow, only 7.5 kilometers across at its narrowest point. We had a brilliant sun, but an absolute black sky. That's probably the hardest thing to get used to, is working in a desert-like environment with a bright sun, but a black sky, no color at all, other than, of course, the blue and white marbled earth always stayed in the same part of the sky. All through our time there, we were there through 72 hours, the Earth doesn't move. And that's because, of course, the moon is rotating once on its axis every time it goes around the Earth in the same time frame. The other level of operation was, let's get this job going. I mean, you only have 72 hours. You're going to have about 22 hours outside the spacecraft. And as one of my colleagues said a long time ago, time is relentless. And you try to get as much done as you possibly can in a hostile environment, but also an environment where there are certain restrictions in how you use the spacesuit and how you use the equipment that's available and the like. So all through my time on the moon, I was trying to record as much as I could the images and the feelings, but at the same time make sure that you didn't stand around and waste a lot of time oohing and aahing over where you were. And I either had an advantage or a disadvantage in that regard as a geologist, because I was there with some very specific background purposes that I was trying to accomplish, not only for myself but for all of my colleagues who were interested in what we would discover and could see on the moon. As the last mission, we really were trying to fill in the holes that were left in our understanding at this level of understanding of the moon as a small planet. And so we really had a pretty focused agenda. I did anyway, and Gene Cernan was a big help in meeting that, although he may not have fully realized all the time what that agenda was. He, as the other pilot astronauts were extremely talented observers. They realized that their mark in the history of space was going to be in part based on how well they performed as geologists and scientists, in a sense, on the moon, and they worked very hard at it. So the training was easy, and particularly once we changed it into a simulation-based training rather than just a show-and-tell kind of training, which it had been more or less before. Again, standing in this valley of Tarslitra on the moon with this black sky and brilliant sun and high mountains was really one of the more meaningful experiences of my life. And I can only ask you to think about something comparable in your lives where you've tried to anticipate what the experience was going to be like before it occurred. But when it did occur, it was far more than you ever could have anticipated. And that's what being on the moon was for me.
Harrison Smith speaking here in Melbourne.
There's an American flag on the moon. We never looked at such a pretty moon.
It's just the beginning, you know we've won the race. Oh, glory will soon be all over the place.
Harrison Smith is still a working geologist. He considers the recent opening of the second of two deep core samples of lunar soil a second Apollo mission to Taurus Littro. Last month, this discussion at the Lunar and Planetary Institute.
I'm Harrison Schmidt, Apollo 17 Lunar Module Pilot.
I'm Chip Shearer from the University of New Mexico.
I'm Clive Neal from the University of Notre Dame.
Well, there are three types of samples that were collected on the surface of the moon that are being examined by this ANCSA program, or the Apollo Next Generation Sample Analysis Program. And these were samples that were collected by Jack from Station 3 during one of the Apollo 17 traverses. And this was a double drive tube. And Gene Cernan hammered this double drive tube into the surface of this landslide deposit that was derived from the South Massif. And the lower portion of this drive tube was placed within this core sample vacuum container that was sealed on the surface of the moon. And then a third type of sample that was analyzed by the ANGSA program were the frozen samples that upon return from Apollo 17 in December of 1972 and January of 1973, they were placed in a freezer and kept frozen at, I think, minus 25 degrees centigrade for 50 years now.
I think it's very important to recognize that already some of those new technologies have benefited the analysis of those samples. For example, we can see inside rocks, inside cores now that we couldn't do 50 years ago. And that means that we can make decisions, much better decisions on what to analyze. A good illustration, Apollo itself stimulated new technology in analytical chemistry, mass spectrometry, and the like.
Oh, the microbeam techniques. And Chip, you've run a microbeam technique, the SIMS lab. The development of SIMS and in situ age dating on these samples, we can now be informed of where to go within these samples, how to cut them, then how to then properly plan out the analyses from those data. It's emphasized by the Apollo 17 orange glasses that they were collected in 1972, and it wasn't until 2007 that it was shown that they actually contained water that was in the interior of the moon that was brought up in these glasses, and that comes from the microbeam techniques. And because those samples had been well curated, they were still available to be used. Yeah, the maturity, understanding how long that regular sample has been exposed to the solar environment on the surface of the moon is critical for understanding the changes that weathering has made on those samples.
The interesting thing about this core that you mentioned, Chip, is that it's seems to be penetrating two avalanches. There is a young avalanche that covered an old one. The old avalanche is probably maybe on the order of about 96 million years exposure, but actually occurred about 150 million years ago. The new avalanche appears that it may have, again, based on these maturity measurements, as well as a cosmic ray exposure age on one of the boulders, that it was exposed about 56 million years.
Well, the other thing that we need to think about here is what caused the avalanches. Was it impacts or was it movement along the Lee Lincoln Fault Scarp that has been mapped out?
My inclination is that it's probably movement along the fault, because now because of the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter camera images we have, we can see that there have been, since the basalts fill the valley floor, there have been four major mass wasting events off the South Massif. The South Massif that we mentioned is 2,100 meters high, over 7,000 feet. It's really, and it's a very steep slope, probably 26, 27 degrees on the average is the slope. And so it doesn't take an awful lot to get this so-called regolith, this debris layer that covers the slope of the massif, to start to move. And there is a thrust fault called the Lee Lincoln Fault that crosses the valley, and there is, I think, very strong evidence that at least the young avalanche was triggered by this movement along that fault. The moon has started to contract. It's cooling, whereas for most of lunar history it was expanding due to the generation of radioisotopic heat. Now that has moved to the point of where it's contracting, and as a sphere contracts, it's going to move over itself. The surface will move over itself.
Yeah, we're starting to see more evidence for modern-day lunar tectonics. Saw it during the Apollo era with the Apollo seismic network.
These type of ridges that cross the moon in many different places have been known for a long time. Prior to Apollo, we knew that these ridges existed, but we didn't understand them. They were called wrinkle ridges and things like that. But now, I think with the evidence we have from Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter images, and also just by having had a chance to drive over one of these scarps and see what the evidence is on the ground, that these are indeed thrust faults that are altering the character of the surface. And now we can go back into the seismic data collected on the Apollo seismic network and start to identify events that have are registered in those seismic things as these kind of thrust faulting events. It's an indication of how important synthesis is to bring various types of data together and try to see what they're telling you in aggregate rather than what they're telling you just in isolation.
And so what's very unique about the ANCSA program is what it does bring is people who work on samples and look at samples using new technologies, but also it brings in people who study the moon remotely, geophysicists, and obviously somebody who's had boots on the ground that brings a personal observations to the ANCSA program. And integrating all of these observations.
Yeah, moonquakes are something, as you know, I'm sort of interested in a little bit. If we did, in fact, penetrate the second layer underneath the youngest avalanche deposit, the samples don't go down as far as we would like, but they go down. They go down quite a ways.
You can never satisfy a geologist.
No, you never can. We always want more samples, but that's. But I think that you know what we've learned, you know, during and after Apollo, is now helping us put this into a much bigger picture.
Well, and operationally, it's important because, as you pointed out in the past, Clive, some of these moonquakes are significant quakes. And that design of any kind of settlement or our operational buildings or equipment has to take into account that they may encounter a quake of significant magnitude.
The significant magnitude, the maximum ground motion lasts for up to 10 minutes, not just, you know, 30 seconds, 90 seconds as we get on this planet, because the moon has what they term a higher seismic Q value. So when it vibrates, the energy is not deadened. It just keeps moving.
Yeah, that was one of the first things that we learned from the Apollo 11 seismometer, was that if the moon gets hit by something, that energy continues to cycle around the moon. Almost any sample has a story to tell. So all of the samples, the Apollo samples that have been collected, and not all of them have been fully studied, unfortunately. These new samples are important, not so much more important than any other sample, it's just that we can gather more information about them, and it also is telling us what we need to do to go back to get information out of the old samples, and how we apply these new technologies to samples collected in the past, and also to samples collected in the future.
Also, what's really clear from the core samples is they represent material from the South Massif, which is very, very difficult to sample. And so essentially this landslide deposit brings this material to the valley floor where it was sampled. And within this core, we now have brand new samples that we haven't been able to, that we haven't seen in other parts of the Apollo collection. So these are new and somewhat unique samples. Some of them are referred to as magnesium sweet rocks, which all have a story to tell with regards to the internal characteristics of the moon, the characteristics of the crust, potentially the characteristics of the mantle.
Through the last 15, 20 years, one of our colleagues, Lars Borg, at the Livermore Laboratories in California has been gradually, systematically getting really very precise analyses of the age of these magnesium sweet rocks. And they're starting to coalesce on a single age, about 4.35 billion years old. That is very interesting, that if there was indeed, as he refers to it, as a magmatic event 4.35 billion years ago on the moon, what was that event? And that's one of the big new questions that we will be looking at as we look at more magnesium sweet samples from this core. I personally think it's what it's recording is a giant impact on the moon, namely the Procolarum impact. And some of the other samples from the Taurus Littoral area that I collected also are starting to indicate that maybe we have, because of that very large impact, actually sampled the deep mantle of the moon. the dunite from again from the South Massif, the Boulder 3 at the Station 2 that we collected there, the troctolite from Station 6 that was part of the rake sample from Station 6. Both of those tend to indicate a rapid change in pressure as they were brought up from deep within the moon. And that change in pressure may well have been the result of the excavation caused by this large Procolarum impact. When I say large, the basin, the Procolarum basin, is 3,200 kilometers in diameter. And so that's big, even for on the lunar scale.
I think looking at those samples, again, putting that in context of what we now know, it does allow us to make big interpretations from itty-bitty little samples that come out of a core tube.
88.3 Southern FM.
The core that we're looking at, it's 70 centimeters long. It does record in its individual components the history of the sun over some significant period of time. We have another core that's 3 meters long that we took at Apollo 17 at a site near the lunar module, Challenger's landing point, that gives us even more of a record. And when one starts to look at the isotopic composition, particularly of nitrogen in that core, something that was measured back in the early 70s, we start to see evidence that we can indeed start to read the history of the sun, at least as it relates to the ratio between nitrogen 14 and nitrogen 15, and what we call a Del 15 ratio shows that possibly about 500 million years ago, the sun went through over a factor of 2 increase in the energy of the solar wind. Now, what else was happening 500 million years ago? Here on Earth, we were going through what's known as an explosion in the diversity and quantity of life in the oceans of the Earth. Is that related to this factor of 2 increase in energy from the sun? More than likely. It's always been thought that the Earth actually warmed during that so-called Cambrian explosion period, when not life became more abundant and more diverse, but we never had direct evidence. Well, with a little more work, we may have actually direct evidence from the moon that indeed the sun did get did give us a warmer Earth. The other aspect of, and maybe one of the most important aspects of the entire Apollo effort, is that we have begun to fully understand, I think, what that environment, as you referred to, Clive, that environment of the early Earth was like. And it was extraordinarily violent. But it was violent here on Earth in a water-rich environment. And it is in that environment we also now know that life started here on Earth. And so piecing that together is going to be a very, very important part of the science from Apollo.
We can learn a lot from Apollo on how to collect samples on the moon, and basically how to understand what the true solar wind content of the regolith is. And this is something that we tried to do with the ANCSA project, is to analyze that headspace gas and
in the core. Some of the preliminary analyses suggest that the core sample vacuum container does contain a lunar component within the gas. Again, this will need to be submitted to other labs for other measurements to be made, but this will be a real breakthrough in better understanding what the volatile concentration characteristics are of the regolith. That's really critical and important to us to understand the interaction between space and the moon's surface. Also, what we ended up doing, what was very unique about the ANCSA program, is that the ANCSA program developed a new methodology to opening up this core sample vacuum container. During the Apollo program, there were only two core sample vacuum containers collected, one during Apollo 17 and one during Apollo 16. Neither had been opened since the before the start of the ANCSA program. And then the program, enlisted Washington University, St. Louis, to develop a collection tool to collect this gas. And the European Space Agency developed a piercing tool that we could pierce this container and sample the gas. So we've developed two new approaches that weren't in existence during Apollo to open these sample containers. These will be useful for the Artemis program.
And not only that, it is in these solar wind volatiles that we really have the resources that will ultimately support lunar settlement and potentially support longer trips to Mars. The solar wind is primarily hydrogen, as a matter of fact, protons, but as they come and hit the moon and they become hydrogen gas in atomic form anyway. But helium is there. Helium-3 is there, which is an interesting potential fusion fuel here on Earth. If you have hydrogen, you can produce oxygen from the regolith just by heating it. It turns out to be very, very important for potential use in what we call cislunar space and a variety of applications for propulsion. One of the new samples that was kept frozen is one from underneath a boulder that has been in continuous shadow for at least 65,000 years. There's some discussion of whether it was longer than that or not. And that sample in itself is the first time is a sample we can look at to try to understand what permanent shadow really means at the poles. And that work is starting to come through thermal luminescence analysis and that kind of thing.
But we need ground truth, because these are all orbital data that we've been looking at. And coming back to the technology that ANCSA's developed to analyze these gases that can evolve in these vacuum-sealed core tubes, this is something that could become routine if you have these types of collections done by the Artemis astronauts. And they're at the poles to see whether or not it's not only in these very cold regions, but around these cold regions that some data seem to suggest. So gathering these types of samples in vacuum by Artemis around some of these permanently shadowed regions could be very, very important for understanding the true potential of what is exactly there that could one day be transported back here to make life better on this planet with clean energy. We have a completely new view of the moon, because during Apollo, the moon was bone dry. Now we find there's a water cycle on the moon. And there are other volatiles that are on the moon that are cold trapped at the poles. But also, there's day-night cycles on the moon of volatiles on the lunar surface. One of the passions I have at the moment is a lunar resource prospecting campaign. What is up there? How much exactly is up there? So we talk about, there's a lot of talk in NASA about using the polar water ice resources because there's billions of tons of that. We don't know that. We don't know that. Now, we could generate a cislunar economy if there are billions of tons and this country says we're going to have a permanent human presence on the moon. Then it gives the commercial sector, oh, we've got a long-term partner there that is going to make our investment pay off, not right away, but we can invest in it because there's a long-term future. There's this new thing that Science Mission Director has called Commercial Lunar Payload Services. Fixed price contract, will take your scientific payload to the moon for X amount of dollars. I contacted those companies and got their hiring statistics. So in 2019, there was over 100% job growth in these companies. 2020, when everything was contracting, it contracted, and there was only 66% job growth in those companies. This is high-paying, high-tech jobs. It's a new sector of our economy that's within our grasp. It enables commercial participation so that the taxpayer investment that is made through NASA grows these industries, and it gives a feedback loop to this
planet which makes society better on this Earth. Helium-3 is what I call a long-term product, because we don't have sustainable fusion reactions. There are multiple minute sustainable fusion reactions being done in Korea and China. And, we need to sort of catch up, because it's happening, because it's gone from millisecond to multiple minutes in about a decade. And as what I found is you can't just be a geologist. You've got to understand policy, you've got to understand economics, you've got to understand engineering. And so I say there's always something new to learn.
Economics.
And he's brought, Chips brought the answer to the forefront by his dogged persistence, let's put it that way.
One can find deposits that are unique, but are they economic? Mm-hmm. Will they allow humans to essentially live off the land on the moon? That we don't have to get supplies from the Earth of oxygen or water. The resources are there. But we need to find out, is there enough, what state they're in, and how do we process them? That's an important next step that I think ANCSA provides us with a step in that direction. Also, a very important aspect with regards to the ANCSA program was training of the next generation of scientists, sample scientists, geologists, engineers. We have the ANCSA program is a program which is multi-generational. It goes from Jack, who's been just so incredibly great with these young professionals. His enthusiasm is just incredible. So there's a broad, broad spectrum of people involved in ANCSA, and allows us to train these individuals for the future and make the real link, generational, multi-generational link, mm-hmm. from Apollo to Artemis. We brought in our early career people and mid-career people and some older career people.
That's you.
to really interact with the processing of these samples. This will be critical for when the Artemis program occurs and new samples come back. We will have a new generation of professionals with experience.
We have new technologies that have primarily come out of the private sector that have to be integrated into what can be done within the government sector. The three of us are really a bridge to the previous generation of people that trained us, mm-hmm. and that were deeply involved in Apollo, a bridge to the new generation that has to carry it forward.
What is gratifying, though, is to see the enthusiasm in that Artemis generation. They want to learn. They want to understand about the moon, and I think they also want to see the 13th human walk on the moon. I mean, 50 years since Apollo 17 in December. So this is now time where that generation can have their Apollo moment.
Speaking last month at the Lunar and Planetary Institute, that was Harrison Smith, Apollo 17 astronaut, and Charles Shearer, research scientist with the University of New Mexico, and Clive Neal, a planetary geology researcher at the University of Notre Dame. Next week on The Space Show, we're going to have more about Apollo 17, including a poem read by Harrison Smith while he was on the moon. So there we go. Next week on The Space Show.
President Kennedy had a dream about Apollo 17. All those the same, Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. Now count down.